that appears to be working. Jamie didn't get admitted. Let's see if he's joining. Let's see if Jamie joined. There we go. Jamie, I thought I admitted you before. I apologize. Okay. I will watch to make sure if people drop out. I had a bunch of internet problems yesterday. So today we're going to talk about torts. I remember when I first started law school, like, the word torts was just like, it just seemed like such a bizarre word. Like, what is a tort? And they would start talking about torts. No, I'd never really heard of it. And it's still, when I just hear the word tort, it still seems kind of like this, I don't know, this smoke, you can't put your hands around it. But today I will try to explain what a tort is and how negligence is a part of a negligence claim. When you're going in an action against someone, is to recover when there's a tort, versus what we've been talking about in breach of contract. When you're injured under a contract, you have a breach of contract claim. When you have a tort injury, you have a negligence claim. So we'll talk about that. And throughout this, I'll be sprinkling some discussions about the standard of care. And the standard of care is important for you guys because that's what you are obligated to perform to as architects, and all professionals have different standards of care. So we're going to talk about how that works. And then a little bit at the end, there's this thing called contribution indemnity, which has to do with how lawsuits work when you have a tort claim or an injury-type claim. And we'll get into that a little bit at the end. So let me go ahead and share my screen. And I have a video today, and I think I learned how to do the share sound, because I did it with my daughter, so hopefully it works for you guys. So give me a second here. So share sound. And okay. Are you guys seeing the big screen or the little screens? Perfect. All right. Let's get to it today. So, negligence tort law is the basic what we're going to talk about. So, what is a tort? A tort is an act or omission that gives rise to an injury or harm to another and amounts to a civil wrongdoing for which courts impose liability. So, what does that really mean? And when somebody does something to you, or in the case of construction, it can be potentially to your property, or in other instances, it can be to the property. So they have this act. They do something, or they fail to act. That's the omission part of it. They fail to do something. They fail to live up to some requirement. And that action, or that failure or omission, causes someone to be harmed. Now, the question of what the harm or their injury is, if it's in the case of a personal injury, obviously you could have a broken arm, you could have all the way to someone being killed. So that's a wrongful death claim. Or in the case of property, you could have trespass. Trespass is actually considered a tort. So, the other thing about torts, if you remember, and contracts are the same way, And we'll principally talk about in this class are civil issues. Civil meaning non-criminal. So our court systems, as you guys probably know, we have a criminal system, and that's your jury of your peers, and all that other good stuff. And then we have the civil system, which is where contracts are resolved, where torts are or contract issues are resolved, negligence and tort issues are resolved, fraud, other types of things that come in. So this is something where the injury results into a civil wrong for which the courts can impose liability. Now, if you remember, we talked about contracts. Sometimes you could have a breach of contract, but if there was no damages, because we have to have all the elements, if there's no damage, you have no breach of contract claim. Well, the same thing could be in a tort. You have to, a negligence claim. You have to have actually this harm for which the courts can impose liability. And liability here means some party, the party who acts improperly, they are the ones that are considered liable. So, The other thing it says here, it says, it includes a duty owed to society imposed by law to act in an acceptable manner. So the interesting thing about that is sometimes in the world of injury and torts, you're going to have statutory requirements of how you're supposed to comply. But here, the duty can rise out of a duty owed to society, meaning you got to act like a good person. You can't just go walk down the street and haul off and knock somebody over. That has some criminal implications of assault and battery and those types of things, but you also have this societal duty. And that's kind of where ultimately the standard of care, which we're going to talk about, comes from. So, now the next question, we talked about contracts for the last 3 weeks. So, and we're only going to have one class on torts, which is good. Although, largely what's going to happen is your profession, and given my experience, most claims will arise out of a contract issue if there are claims ever brought against you. Knock on wood, nobody ever has you're never involved in a lawsuit, you've done a great job, your firm does a good job, and you don't have to worry about issues with those types of things. But the reason why we wanted to talk a lot about contracts and breach of contracts, and we talked about that for about 2.5 lectures, is because that's going to be more important, and you have to kind of learn how a contract works. But torts are still issues. You know, people get injured on construction sites, and sometimes it's due to the architect, sometimes it's due to the contractor, sometimes it's their own fault. So what's the difference? So the first one, which is important to remember, is the loss or the injury from a breach of contract is based on what are the obligations and what's the deal between the two parties. So if you remember, if you have a duty, a breach of duty, I'm sorry, you have in the contract you have a duty, you have a breach of duty, and then you have the injury, and then you have the damages, that loss has to be defined by what the contract said you're supposed to do. I'm going to build this building, and I'm going to have it completed for you by January 1st. Or I'm supposed to pay you for the services. It's not going to be something outside of the contract. If you never had a promise for something to do, it's not in the contract you've been promised, they can't bring a breach of contract action against you. So it's based on that agreement just between those parties of the contract. Now, as a quick kind of maybe a correction here, so the obligations agreed to between two parties, as I talked about, I think, in the first discussion with contracts, there could be more than two parties in a contract. So probably between two or more parties, but it's all defined by that contract. The tort itself has nothing to do with the contract. Some people may, you know, legal scholars may say, well, there's a contract that everybody owes to society. Like I said, to act as a nice person and not knock somebody over. But you don't have a written contract that your actions are based on, and the loss or your injury for a tort is not based on that. It comes to this question of, did you act reasonably? Were you negligent in your actions? And how is it determined whether your actions were negligence? Again, looking at society. Now, sometimes there may be a statute out there that defines the role you're supposed to take, or defines the duty or the standard by which you're supposed to operate, and that helps determine whether there's negligence. But a lot of times it's just what society has said or what common law has said over the years. So, and then the last point, there's this kind of there's this one area in our profession, and can be in other professions, and there's this overlap between negligence in a contract and negligence in tort. Now, if you remember when we talked about contracts, you could have been you're supposed to perform in accordance with the language of the contract, the duties that are set forth there. And we talked about it, and I have mentioned standard of care in a contract, and actually you're going to see in your construction contracts, and in 2 weeks when we get into the B101, there's a provision in your owner-architect agreement that is specifically states what your standard of care is. It says you shall perform in accordance with X, Y, and Z. That's the standard of care. So here you have the situation where a negligence standard, meaning how you're supposed to act, becomes contractual language. And so that contractual language, you can be sued in contract for acting negligent. Now, it's not a tort, it's a contract breach because it's contractually put in, the language is put in the contract. So because of that standard is now a contractual obligation, when you've breached that contract, the other side, the party with whom you have that agreement, they're going to bring this lawsuit against you in breach of contract based on your negligence. So there's this overlap where the parties, where the actions appear to be the same, but your remedy through the court system is different. Another way to think about it is, if you have a contract, you and I have this contract where I'm going to build this, I'm going to design your house, and you're supposed to pay me $150,000, but I'm supposed to design this house properly, and I design it, and they start to build it, and the wall falls down. You're going to bring a claim against me, but you're not going to bring a tort claim or a negligence claim against me. Now, if the wall falls down, and this is another part of it, if the wall falls down and hurts someone, that person, because I don't have a contract with her or him, that person's going to bring a tort claim against me, but a good lawyer is going to say, and we know that they committed negligence because their contract said they were supposed to perform in accordance with this written standard of care. And so the good lawyer who's representing the injured party doesn't have to use the societal norms. They can simply use the contract language to establish what the standard of care is. So that's where you have this overlap. And then there's this weird thing called the economic loss rule, which you guys will not be tested on it, but basically it says that third party has only limited areas in which they can claim that negligence based on your contract language. If it's a sudden and calamitous injury or it's personal injury, then they can do that. But if it's just a loss to their revenue or costs, they can't use this tort action, because they don't have a contract with you, to come after you. It's a little, it's two or three levels down, so like I said, I don't ever test on it, but I wanted to let you guys know, because there is a thing called the economic loss rule that will be applicable from time to time, and if you're ever in a lawsuit, your lawyer may say, oh, we have a defense based on the economic loss rule. It's something that's favorable for you guys. So, any question with that so far? Excellent. Okay. So why do we have tort law? You know, we talked about what's the reason for contract law. Remember, contract law was to predict future, to make sure that we have predictability. Well, predictability is actually the same thing here. And it also includes the reason to promote safety. Now, the contracts, predictability, if you have a standard of care or you have these requirements on the contract, you want to have safety, and most of the time you're going to have safety language in your agreement. But overall, tort law and negligence actions are to make sure you're being safe because the society says to that. So, and then the other question is, the other thing is to allocate the risk of loss or injury. So, when you have an injury, you want to say, this is what happened, this is the reason why it happened, and this is who's responsible. So, if you think about it in a contract, it's pretty simple. It says, I'm supposed to do this for you. I'm supposed to design this, have the designs done by a certain point in time, and the building, when it's built, it's not going to fall down. You have an obligation to pay me for those, provide me information, and whatever else is on that side. So, the risks and the obligations are spelled out. And it's much more clear, or can be more clear, as to how the risks fall and who's responsible for what. Because this is in tort law, there's no contract between you and the person walking down the street that you knock over. The courts come in and use tort law to kind of figure out how to allocate risk or loss between the parties. Is someone acting in such a manner that they put themselves at risk? are you the party that caused them to be at risk? Is the injury sufficient enough that their actions or your actions created that injury, created the problem? So that's where this risk of loss or injury is. Okay, so there's different types of torts, a kind of an overall level. And some may be civil and some may be criminal. So we have the intentional, we have negligent, and then negligence. So your negligent torts are going to be ones that we're mostly going to talk about in the class. You're going to have things where you didn't do it on purpose, but you didn't follow the standard of care. That's your negligent torts, and that's what the most of the rest of the lecture will cover. But I wanted to cover or highlight intentional torts, because they are considered a tort. So we have one. Some of them have this criminal, quasi-criminal, or actually truly criminal nature to it, and that's why it makes sense that they would be criminal, because they're intentional. Somebody intentionally tried to create harm. If you think about it, if you remember, we were talking about a tort is where there's harm to someone, and if you intentionally harm, well, of course it makes sense that that would be a criminal action. But you need to have civil remedies, and that's why people have claims. So we have battery is somebody getting hit, assault putting another person in fear of immediate or harmful contact. So you don't have to, so you always hear like, oh, they've been there's a charge for assault and battery. Because if you're, unless somebody strikes you and you have no idea, you don't see it coming, most of the time, having battery against you, the other person that's being injured is going to see that coming, so there's an assault. But those are also torts for which you can bring a civil claim. Trespass. Now, trespass is interesting, because if you remember, you have to have an injury to be successful in a tort claim. And so where's the injury in trespass? I mean, just because I step on your property, I'm not allowed to step on your property. How's that an injury? Well, trespass goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. And it had to do with the feudal lords and different people's property of what they used it for. And so that was the real property. Was such an important part of people's societies and how they operated and everything else, that when laws started taking shape, literally, like I said, thousands of years ago, so when people started creating laws and everything else, they determined that it was as bad as hitting someone as it was to stepping on someone's property or trying to take over someone's property. So if there's a no trespassing sign and you step on that property, you are technically committing trespass and a tort. And they could potentially claim against you that it was a tort. Now, it depends on what the injury is and what the value of the injury is and other damages, but trespass is something that is both a criminal action, could be criminal, and, of course, it's a tort. Conversion. Conversion on the criminal side is considered theft. So taking or destroying another person's property or stealing it. So that's conversion. And then others are false imprisonment, which could be on the criminal side is kidnapping. Intentional infliction of emotional stress, that would probably fall under assault in the criminal side. And then defamation and libel, which I was just reading an article today. There's a couple of defamation actions that are out there going on right now. Those are all considered actions where it's an intentional tort, where someone has intentionally acted with malice aforethought, and they are causing injury to someone, and the other party has suffered damages. So, any questions on intentional torts or the list of them? All right. So, like I said, there's two types of tortures, your negligent side and there's your intentional side. So now we're going to talk about the negligent side. So what is negligence? So negligence is causing loss or injury by failing to act in accordance with the applicable level of care and caution. So this is where we're going to start to get a little bit into standards of care and care and caution. So what is the applicable level of care and caution? Meaning, what does that mean? Like, what am I supposed to do? Well, depending on who you are, what you do, where you are located, those are going to dictate and govern what your standards are. So this is when I said, in a contract action, it's going to spell out what your obligations are. In a tort claim, it's different. And so in some societies, and in some days and ages, I mean, if you even take a look at where we stand now, so the Me Too culture, which is long overdue but has risen, the things that happened before, not that long ago, the standards in society didn't look at that as someone violating those standards, but they are. And so it changes. There are some things that we'll talk about, especially for design professionals and more toward what you guys look at and what you guys have to do. It's going to stay pretty standard and steady. But you have to understand that the level of care and caution that somebody needs to perform to or act to or live their life to can be different in different places. And it can also be different people. So you're an architect, or you'll be an architect eventually. And you'll have special training and standard for the work that you're going to perform. You can't expect a layperson to be able to understand how to design like you do, because they don't have the training. For the same reason why no one would expect you to be able to go in and perform surgery on someone. So the standard of care that applies to you would be at doing design work is going to be different than the standard of care of someone who wants to put up a deck in their backyard or their own, and they design it themselves. There's different standards of care that's going to fall in between a layperson and a profession. And then within professions, what they're supposed to and how they're supposed to act drives their care and caution. So, as I said, it's society drives this. And then once you get this kind of societal issue, you get the location, the types of people involved, the professions and otherwise. Then if someone has breached that standard of care, if there is this tort claim or this negligence claim, you're going to bring a cause of action. You're going to have a lawsuit, or you're going to have an arbitration. And so there you're going to build, and this goes back to our hierarchy chart that we had on the very first day. You're going to start to use case law to build and to define what the standard of care is for that action or event or profession, and that's the creation of common law. So case law is used to help define the standard of care, and it helps establish hundreds or thousands of years ago that trespass was a tort. As they started writing things down, they started saying trespass is something where it's an injury to someone, it's a tort, and you look now at old case law and it explains why. Someone when they get in a car accident, or someone when a wall falls down on them. All these things you start to look at the case law to establish what is your standard of care, who's supposed to do what, and what injury is going to, and did that cause the injury? And the last point on the screen here is ultimately, no matter what you claim, if you're the injured party, no matter what it says in your lawsuit, the question of really whether negligence occurred, whether the party should be considered liable for their actions, is going to be determined in our court system by a trier of fact. Now, the trier of fact, there's two things in the law. There's trier of fact and trier of law. The trier of law is always going to be the judge, or if it's an arbitration, an arbiter. They're going to say, no, you can't put this evidence in because the law of evidence says you can or can't let it in. If the evidence goes in, the evidence then becomes a fact of the case on which the parties that are determining liability or non-liability, or in criminal case, guilt or non-guilt or innocence. So if the evidence goes in, it becomes a fact which they are going to determine. So that's the trier of fact. Now, in criminal law, the trier of fact will always be a jury. You can waive it if you want, but everybody wants a jury in a criminal case because you're entitled constitutionally to a jury of your own peers. In civil law, which is where you're going to see negligence claims, you may or may not have a jury. So, sometimes it has to do with the contract, sometimes it has to do with the agreement of the parties. And so if you don't have a jury, the judge will be both the trier of fact and the trier of law. The judge will make the decisions on what facts he or she wants to listen to, and then once they come into evidence, the trier of fact, the judge, will weigh the validity of those facts. I'll give you an example in the construction world where the judge, I had a trial, where the judge was the trier of fact and trier of law, and how he looked to weigh those facts after there was a legal decision on whether the evidence should come in, and then ultimately made a legal decision, the judge made a legal ruling on the outcome of the case. So I represented a design manufacturer, design build of a company that builds what's called rack supported structures. If you guys know what a tinker toy is, or like an erector set, kind of think about that, where instead of they built warehouses largely that stored lots of goods or materials. So instead of when you build the warehouse, you put up a steel frame, and then you put in a bunch of shelves inside of it. The rack itself was the structure of the building, the whole shelving system. So you built this huge grid, and that held up the building as well as the grid. It was this three-dimensional grid, a bunch of spaces, where they would put pallets, and they would store, the lawsuit we were in was a food storage company. So they had, literally, they had rows and rows and rows and rows of these grid systems, and they went up about 75 or 80 feet, and in each one of these cubes, you would load pallets, and some would have cereal, and some would have pasta, and so all these dry goods, and they have a computer that would come in and would pick up the pallets and put them onto conveyor belts and load them into trucks and then drive them off to the grocery stores. So we brought this guy in. There was this long lawsuit about it, and there was a question about design issues and lots and lots of problems. And the plaintiff brought an expert in, and the expert came in to testify as to why the design was in violation of the standard of care, why my client failed to do what they were supposed to do. So we first challenged the expert's qualifications to say that they weren't qualified to be that. So the judge made a rule on the trier of law as to whether the expert could testify to it. And he ruled in favor. He said that the expert could bring in its evidence, that the expert had sufficient qualifications to argue or present testimony on what the standard of care is by which our design should be judged. So then the evidence came in. Now, we had taken his deposition earlier, and in his presentation of the evidence, he had talked about our client's failure to perform, and it was going to be the same evidence that he was going to present in the trial, because we got it in the deposition. One of my colleagues had found, in researching this expert, some cases in which he had testified in. And in fact, we found one scenario where one of the issues upon which he was rendering an opinion, he took the exact opposite opinion in that trial than he was taking with us. So when we got him in the deposition, we had him testify and say, is this your belief? What's this based on? And we locked him in to this testimony. And then we got him on the trial, and he said the same thing. And then we brought out, so we had the question whether he was qualified. Then the evidence came in as a fact. The judge then became a trier of fact to listen to this evidence, or this just standard of care. And then we then pulled out the other lawsuit in which she testified in a 180-degree opposite position. And we used that to discredit his opinions and his testimony as to what he actually, the facts that he found, and what the standard of care is and what his opinions were. And so in that instance, the judge is now ruling or determining the facts as the trier fact. Are these facts credible? And then as a result of that, did my client commit negligence? Could the judge believe the evidence or the testimony from this expert who obviously completely 180 degree flipped the position? And ultimately, at the end of the case, or actually when the plaintiff finished presenting their evidence, the judge made a legal ruling to say there was not sufficient evidence because the facts were not believable and tossed the case out. So we actually won without even having to put on our case based on legal rulings and the judge being the trier of fact. If it was a jury, we may not have gotten that far, but there's issues. So, but that's where the difference between a trier of fact and a trier of law is, and something to kind of to think about if you're ever in an action or ever whatever. What is a trier of fact? What's a trier of law? So, any questions on that? All right. So, sometimes when you're going through, and we'll talk about the elements in a little bit. Sometimes negligence in a case is automatic. Because of something happened, you've considered proven negligence. And then all you have to do is show that the party acted negligently. Then you have to show that that party, all you have to do is show that party had a duty to you, because if they've committed negligence, they've breached that duty. So whatever they breached, did they owe it to you or as opposed to somebody else? And then there's an injury. So, in this instance, one way that negligence is automatic, and it's so you don't have to prove that part of your case, is violation of law or regulation. So if you are supposed to design a space and it's supposed to be in compliance with a code, and you didn't do your calculations right, and you're not code compliant, your loads weren't right, your wind loads, your snow loads, or whatever the code is. Maybe it's the ADA. Maybe you haven't put enough for accessibility. If there's a law or a regulation and you have failed to do that or you violated that, it's considered you've automatically been negligent. Now, the party bringing the claim still has to say that they were injured and that your negligence caused their injury. But it's one element of the case that you've already proven. And the reason is it's to make sure you comply with the law. Everybody wants to follow the law. So sometimes there are rules and regulations as opposed to, remember I said, society-driven. And obviously, if you can show, if you're in a court or you're in arbitration, and you can say, I have this regulation, they were supposed to put in accessibility, you know, 3 feet doors and curb cuts, and their countertops were supposed to be at a certain height, or they were whatever they were supposed to do, or they ran a red light. As a result of those actions, I can show the court, look, here is a violation of exactly what they did wrong. I don't have to show that they were negligent. Now I just have to show that they owed a duty to me, and I was injured because of their negligence. So it's important. The other thing is negligent actions of an agent, and we'll talk about agency, more specifics about agency, who's an agent, but they're automatically tied to the principal. So as a real simple discussion, so you're an architect and you're working for an architectural firm, and you're not in contract with the homeowner for whom the house is being designed. The firm is. But you are an agent of your firm. So if your negligence in designing the house causes injury, the wall falls down and hurts someone, your firm will be held liable because your acts are tied to your firm as the principal. There's some other stuff, and we'll get here, like if the agent acts negligently toward a third party, it has to be within scope of authority. There's apparent authority and other stuff. We'll talk a little bit more about agency in another lecture, where there can be a separation or a break between the agent and the principal. But generally, for the purpose of negligence and torts, your actions as the agent will be tied to the principal. Any questions on that? Okay. Yeah. You do not, but that's a great question. So, to be, and I'm going to, like I think I said last week, I'm going to repeat the question because of the microphone and what I can hear versus what the recording microphone is. So the question was, do you have to be a licensed architect to be the agent of the firm? And the answer is no. And like I said, we're going to get much kind of burrow in deeper about agency in another lecture, but an agent is someone based on what their authority is. So you can come in and be an associate, and if you have the authority from the owner of the company or the company you're working for to design the space, then you are acting on their behalf. If you have the authority as an associate to drive to the project site, and you're not licensed, you haven't taken an exam, but you're walking the project site and looking at things, you have the authority of the company to act on their behalf. It's going to tie you to that. The licensing issue is tied to both statutory issues. You have to be statutorily licensed. You have to be registered with the state. And then whoever's going to be sealing those drawings are going to be licensed. And so clearly someone who is licensed and part of the company will be an agent. But you need not be that. And in fact, even if there's someone who isn't an architect, let's say that they are, you have someone who is helping out with, I don't even know, like interior design stuff, or maybe even management, and they're not like project management, they're not doing anything about the design of the space, and that individual goes to a project site just to have a meeting, not about the design, it's not about a wall falling down or anything else, and they're driving their car, and they get in a car accident. Well, they're not an architect. They're not. The accident has nothing to do with the design. It has nothing to do with the principal part of the business. But someone's injured. The injured party can bring a claim against the company as well as the individual, saying that the individual is acting within the scope of his or her authority on behalf of the company. And so it's not just the individual that hurt me, but it's the company as well. So that's where your agency ties in. So it doesn't have to be a licensed architect. Any other questions on that? Okay. I do. Show video panel. There we go. Okay. So, next, we talked about elements. We had elements of a contract, a breach of contract. So let's talk about elements for negligence. So, surprisingly or not, it's pretty similar. You have your duty. In the contract, the duty is identified by the contractual obligations. Here, it's the standard of care or duty of care owed to others. So you have your duty. You have your breach of duty. Meaning you breached that standard of care. Whatever that duty was that you're supposed to owe, you breached it. You failed to act or live up to it. And then there's causation. Causation creates this has to be this causal link between the breach and the consequences. And sometimes in legal terms, they call it the proximate cause. And if you can create, if you can create a separation between the breach, that duty and that breach, and the injury, to show that the actions or omissions was not the proximate cause of the injury, then there's no negligence. So you have to have this causal link. There has to be this nexus, this connection between the duty and the breach, and the fourth element, which is the damage, the injury that was suffered. In the civil claim, you're going to be seeking monetary damages, but if if it's a personal injury, it's going to be a physical injury that, because of the way our system is, it's going to be monetized. So, in this case, so you have to have all four of those. If you fail to get any one of those four and you're bringing a claim, then your claim will fail. And all of these four elements are going to be up to the trier of fact to determine, did these four elements exist and were you able to prove that? So when a case goes to a jury, there's going to be these jury questions. They're going to say, did you find that there was a duty and what was that duty? And they fill that out. And it depends on what the jury questions are. And there's legal mumble-jumble that goes back and forth in creating what those jury questions are. But they go through each one and they say duty, breach, causation, damages. And if they, their understanding and interpretation and weighing of the facts believe all four have occurred, then there's negligence, and then they would go to the next step of awarding monetary damages. So, those are your elements. All right, let's talk about some examples of them to kind of explain. Yeah. All right, let me do something here. I think I know. Did that just come up? Did it go away? Is it still there or did it go away? Okay. Let me see if I can move that. I opened up the share different today. There, it should go away shortly, the top thing. Okay, good. Yeah, for whatever reason, when I opened it up today, it came up differently, and about halfway through, I'm like, I want to see your guys' faces, those who have their cameras on. I know you don't, and you don't have to have your camera on, by the way. It's okay, but I like to see people's faces that do, because then I feel like I'm talking to somebody. So I pulled it up, and I think that's where the black screen is, so I moved it away. All right. Okay, the duty of the standard of care. So there's standard care in general. This is the first couple slides, and then we're going to talk about the professional standard of care, which applies to you guys. So, the standard of care in general, the society's standard of care, it's a legal duty to act as an ordinary, prudent, and reasonable person. So you're just supposed to be yourself. It's what society says you're supposed to be. How you're supposed to walk. How you're supposed to talk. How you're supposed to get along with people. And those obligations can apply ultimately to criminal, but in the civil world, the standard's a little bit lower. It's by preponderance of the evidence instead of beyond a reasonable doubt. But you just need to act like an ordinary, reasonable, prudent person. And that standard is applicable to everyone. But as I said, the standards could be different for different people and different professions. So the profession side is pretty simple. If I'm an architect, I have a duty to, when I'm walking down the street as a person, even though I'm an architect, I act like every person. But when I'm performing my service as an architect, my standard of care is looked at as another architect would be performing, not the ordinary person walking down the street. But how does the different standards apply to different people? Well, if you have a mental or physical handicap, is it reasonable for that person to observe and act in the same way as someone else? So this is something where it's probably more of a mental issue. People that have mental handicaps or mentally incapacitated or things like that. Are their actions justified? Are their actions excused due to their handicap or their affliction? Such that even though a reasonable person wouldn't act that way, is the standard of care to be applied to them fair and safe? So, probably an easier way to understand this second point is, someone gets charged for murder and they have an insanity defense. You have to prove, so they're not criminally liable, that they were acting, that they were insane when they acted, and so therefore the criminal requirement of malice aforethought, which is an intentional act to kill someone, did not apply. And the same thing could be happening to someone who maybe committed a battery. Maybe you're walking down the street and someone comes up and just hauls off and slugs you. You don't know who they are. You don't know what they are. And it may turn out that person had a mental affliction. You don't know. That could be a potential defense, because is the standard of care applicable to that? So those are normal people, not professionals, where the standard of care may have a different application. Another area of where the standard of care may be different people is, let's say you see someone on the street who is injured, and you try to help that person, and you're not a doctor, but maybe you had training in first aid, but you were never a doctor, so you're not a professional. You may be held different to a different standard of care because someone was able to show that you had first aid training than had the other person walking down the street and she came and helped the same person and had no training. The tort would be you tried to help that person and they were injured further, or you caused additional damage because you weren't able to properly administer the first aid. So as a non-professional, you may be a standard of care because of your background and training. What's reasonable for you may be applied to that. So does that make sense how it can be both? But like I said, the separation between the normal person and the profession is pretty simple, but between how it applies to different people in different circumstances, that's kind of where it gets a little grayer. Does that make sense to you guys? Okay, good. And then this last point kind of dovetails on what I was just saying. Regular people, with greater than average skills or ability are held to a higher standard of care than a reasonable person. So if I can show that if I'm the injured party, if myself or my lawyer can show that the person who was acting that caused me injury, or their omission, their failure to act, caused me injury, and that person had a higher level of care, had taken classes in first aid, had skills, greater skills, I can show that their standard of care was higher, so they should have administered the first aid more skillfully, and they failed to, and therefore they breached that different standard of care. So that's what this last point, kind of taking the same thought. One little last point that's interesting about the standard of care in general, if we take, again, this injured party, there is no societal duty, there is no societal standard of care to require you, even if you have greater skills or your profession, to act to aid someone. So this kind of goes on to this, there's the concept of what's called a Good Samaritan defense. But let's say I'm a doctor, and I'm an ER doctor, and I see someone that's injured, they get in a car accident, they get hit, and I see someone bleeding, and they're injured. And I'm standing right there. Even though I have the skills, even though I'm a professional, that I could administer aid and potentially assist in the care of that individual who was injured, there's no societal requirement for me to do that. So my omission or my failure to perform medical services, of which I have the training, is not a breach of a duty. And therefore, my inaction or my omission is not negligent. Now, if I step in as a professional, then I may be looked at with a higher standard of care. And then there's the questions of whether there's what's called the Good Samaritan defense, is if you administered it properly or improperly, and that's another level of going in. But know that simply because you have the training doesn't require you to act, and the failure to act is not negligence. Okay? that protects you. And, you know, most people are good people. You go back to the ordinary, prudent, and reasonable person. Most people are going to help out that injured person that got hit by a car, including the doctor or the nurse or the trained EMT or whomever, because they're ordinary, reasonable, and prudent. But if they don't, that's okay. Okay, let's go to the next one. So, as part of this, back to this trier facting, reasonableness is really important in determining whether they performed and lived up to the standard of care. So, back to this issue of the doctor that she fails to or decides to not assist someone, is that reasonable? And the courts have come down to that instance and say, yes, it is reasonable, because there's all these other things going back to the unilateral contract between you and a doctor when you go to a doctor's office. When you have that unilateral contract, it's never in writing. You anticipate that the doctor is going to perform services for you and perform services in accordance with the doctor's standard of care, and that you're going to pay the doctor for that. Is it reasonable for the ordinary doctor to administer aid to someone injured on the street, not knowing if they're going to have the same conditions of where they would normally perform those services or that they would be paid for it otherwise? And the courts have said no. But if there is an obligation to perform, whether it's the ordinary person not to hit someone or driving the car should they have followed the traffic signals, were they driving too fast in the snow, those are things where the jury or the judge, the triers of fact, are going to look at all the facts there, and they're going to determine, was the individual being charged with the negligence, the party who is claimed to have breached the duty, were they acting reasonable? So that's this, how do you figure it out? The proof, that's where the jury weighs everything. They weigh the evidence. That's where in my case, where I had this expert, or the other side had this expert, who sounded great and was really powerful for their case, the judge said, you know what? I cannot reasonably believe this expert because he testified the exact opposite some other time. So, was it reasonable? So that's what we're going to look into. And was the action by my client, in this case, the court made a legal decision that the case was to be dismissed because there was no evidence that could say our actions were reasonable or unreasonable because the expert failed to apply a standard of care. So the next point here is the juries, as this may not be aware, in almost all cases, the juries aren't aware. They don't understand what the standard of care is. And that's one of the obligations or the duties of the lawyer. I need to be able to explain to the jury through my people going in and testifying, whether it's an expert witness or someone else, what's the standard that this person should live by? Sometimes it's really easy. See this traffic cam? He ran a red light. That's a violation of the law. They violated the law, so that's a violation of the standard of care. That's easy. But if the wall falls down, the architect's going to say it was built improperly. I did a good design. My design was sufficient. The party who's injured when the wall fell down is going to say, well, here's what my expert says. The expert says the standard of care for this type of design is X. They were supposed to design it in this way. The snow loads, the wind loads, or whatever is the cause of the wall falling down. And so someone needs to explain to the jury what that standard of care is. When we get into professions, it's compared to not the ordinary person, it's the ordinary professional. So this expert is going to talk about that. A civil engineer is going to talk about what a civil engineer does. An accountant is going to talk about what an accountant does. Farmer, even though it's not a profession, but maybe an expert witness, is going to say, this is what a farmer does, the standard of care. So experts can come in all shapes and sizes, and they're all trying to determine and establish what is the standard of care, that duty, that obligation that the individual performing the act needed to live up to. Any questions on that? Okay. So let's talk a little bit about professional standard of care, because this applies directly to you guys. So a professional is a person who occupation requires sufficient skill and judgment that it would not be fair to require him or her to guarantee results. So obvious examples, somebody that's licensed doctor, lawyer, architect, accountant, those types of things. In the construction world, there are times that people are not professionals, but the standard of care is applicable so narrowly to them that you kind of follow the same rules that we're going to go through here for professional standard of care. So like, you know, a normal electrician is what a normal electrician is, and that wouldn't necessarily be professional standard of care. But there may be a specialty area in the electrical work where you need a specialty expert, and there's this professional standard of care. I had a case where we were a pump manufacturer, and we made these are huge industrial pumps that moved hundreds of thousands of gallons of water. And this was for a wastewater treatment facility that basically crap and both human waste and I think this was just a human wastewater as opposed to stuff that came off the streets and the sewage and everything else. But it all comes into a big vat, gets swirled around, the pump does certain things and pumps it out. But we design pumps, and the pumps are supposed to work in a certain set of parameters. So it may not necessarily be a design specifically for this tank and for the system. It's like an off-the-rack pump. But it's a specialty pump. And what ended up happening was the pump was installed, and the pump started vibrating. It created this resonance where the water and the other crap, literally, that was in this tank created a vibration such that the connections of the pump to the sides of the tank vibrated, and the pump literally vibrated apart and failed. And my client then replaced it. And we went through a whole host of pumps. We were not the designer of the system. That was the architect and the engineer. And our pump was not designed specifically for that. It was an off-the-rack pump. But when we got into testimony and the experts, there was a series of opinions by the expert as to whether our pumps were properly designed for the system by us, and it became a professional type question where they kind of followed this. So, the same kind of standards, I guess, is what you say, or the standard of care for that type of pump. Okay, what else if you're dealing with specifically, though, a profession? So if you're a professional, often what you're going to say is there's not a guarantee. That's one difference between a warrant, when the contractor provides a warranty, and the contractor, their standard of care is 100% new and good, and I warrant this is going to work exactly what I say, and a professional. Professional can't guarantee, a doctor can't guarantee a cure, lawyers can't guarantee you're going to get acquitted or win your case. Architect can guarantee that design is 100%. So you have to create the standard of care. When we get into the contract, when we get into the second half of the semester, we'll talk about construction contract in detail. There's a section in our warranty of what the contractor is going to warrant. You will never see language in an architect's contract that says, I warrant this design. And in fact, they do. The insurance company will not provide insurance because you cannot build a perfect design. You cannot design a perfect, or you cannot build a perfect building as the architect. You cannot design a perfect building. Your drawings are never going to be 100%. So standard of care is applicable to professionals in the construction world. Warrant is applicable to the contractor. So this is where we, a little bit of divergence from general society. In general society, you're not going to warrant someone that you're going to walk down the street and not hit someone. There's no warrant out there. You're going to act in accordance with standard care. When you get into construction and you have this contract, and this goes back to what I said earlier, the contract you have between the owner and the architect is going to say, I, architect, am going to act in accordance with the standard of care. the contract between the owner and the contractor is going to say, I, contractor, warrant that my work is 100% and good and new, etc., etc. So that's one difference between contracts and professionals, especially architects, in the construction industry. The last point on here is probably the most important language you're going to see, and when we get into the B101, it's with respect to professional standard of care. When you get into the B101, you're going to see this. There will be some form of a question dealing with this second bullet here on the exam. So a professional standard of care is the level of skill and care which an ordinary person of the profession would observe under similar circumstances at the same time and location. So it's the ordinary person is similar to what we were talking about in general standard of care, but it's the ordinary person of the profession. So I, as an architect, am going to act like an ordinary architect, and I'm going to act reasonably and prudent as what that ordinary architect is going to act. Not an ordinary person, but an ordinary architect. If I'm a doctor, I'm going to be acting reasonably and prudently as an ordinary doctor would act. Now, sometimes you may find a contract. So I've done some contract. I did a contract for a nuclear power plant. And they did another contract for the decommissioning of a nuclear power plant. Obviously, the engineering in that was very sophisticated. And nuclear energy is very dangerous. So in that contract, we changed the word ordinary to highest. Because we wanted to say, you can't be the ordinary nuclear engineer. You have to be the highest standard of a nuclear engineer. We wanted, because of what was going on, them to be acting higher than the ordinary nuclear engineer. So in that instance, the normal standard of care without a contract for that nuclear engineer would be what you're seeing on the screen, but we contractually increased or elevated that standard of care. So this goes back to that earlier slide where sometimes contract and torts kind of overlap. If the engineer performing the designs for us when we were decommissioning the power plant failed to act at the highest level and something went wrong, we would bring a breach of contract action saying it violated the standard of care to act as the highest nuclear engineer. So contractually you can modify it, but normally what you're going to see is it's an ordinary person of the profession, an ordinary architect, ordinary doctor, ordinary engineer, under similar circumstances at the same time and same location. So time and location. If you're designing something in California or San Francisco, your ordinary architect has to take into consideration earthquakes. That architect does not have to comply with that standard when they're designing something in Illinois because we're not on a fault line. So location is important. Time sometimes comes into factor as opposed to that you have to have turned something around in the speed of time. What's the same time frame under which you're working? What are the pressures? I see less causes of action based on time. Normally it's similar circumstances. I'm designing a nuclear plant, I'm designing a stadium, designing a hospital. That's the circumstances. The location is the geographical one. Those are where you're going to see issues where you have to determine what standard is in that area for that project at that time. Okay. Next thing on professional standard care. We talked about expert witnesses. So, an expert witness is from the same profession, typically, and they're required to prove they need to show what the applicable standard of care is. So the expert has to get up. If I remember, I was talking about that case where we brought in this expert and they were trying to testify as to the standard of care of what my client did in that rec-supported building. And in fact, the issue that was before the court, he testified the 100% opposite of it. They failed to prove the standard of care just because they weren't credible. they took two different positions. So the court said, well, I don't know which is which, so I don't know what the standard of care is, and we got the case dismissed. But that's what the expert witness is required to do. Now, you have an expert, and especially with professions, where I say it's above the ken of the jury. As I said, most juries don't even understand what the normal standard of care is. I mean, I guess you could say to them, walking down the street, you can't hit somebody, and they probably understand that. But trying to ascertain what's required for design of the building and how snow loads work or how wind loads work or nuclear issues or hospital clean rooms or whatever it is that's being designed, the jury isn't going to understand just off the bat the specifics of that. So that's what the expert witness is there. They're supposed to come in and say, here's my qualifications, here's what I've done for the last 25 years, I've looked at this design, I looked at the system as it was built. In my experience, my custom and practice, of all the years that I'm doing it, I do A, B, C when I design it. That's the standard. And here's the articles I rely on to say it's A, B, C. And here's my position of where it's on A, B, C. And here's this, and here's that. And then I looked at it, and they did A, B, D. And they violated the standard of care. So the expert witness is there to explain to the jury what the standard is and then ultimately make an opinion as to whether the individual properly performed in the standard of care. Well, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, so it's really interesting. He was very credible and was well educated, and I think that had he not gotten caught up in that, was like, so what happens oftentimes is they become professional experts. They determine they can make more money on an hourly basis working in the litigation industry and testifying than they can going out and getting their own business and hawking their wares and doing what they're supposed to do. And so what happens with this guy is, yes, he was a bad expert because he got caught. There was an expert that I worked that I probably deposed him a half a dozen times, and he was so slippery. But God, he was good in front of a jury. I never would hire him because he was probably one of the best architectural experts in Chicago for a decade. I ended up hiring his partner, and I work with him still to this day. But this guy, and I will not name his name, he was so smooth and so slippery, but so good, because he resonated authority, and he spoke just the way he presented it. And he was so smart that he never took a position that ever put him in where he had an opposite or countered it. So he was as slimy as the guy that I caught on the stand. He was just much better at it. So this guy who was, like, and everybody used him. And you're like, you go to a deposition, you're like, oh, who's your expert? Like, oh my God, all the plaintiffs used him because he was so good. I'm like, oh, okay. And I, you know, you get it, and you're like, hey, Bob, that wasn't his name. Like, hey, Bob, how you doing? Like, hey, Mike. And we all knew the dance. Now, toward the end of his career, he was not as good. He was not as sharp. And so he would, because he kind of started to believe his little, he was like a legend in his own spare time. And you could get him. So the latter half a dozen, or maybe not half a dozen, two or three depositions I took at him, I challenged him and I'd get him angry. And once you get him angry, then he becomes less credible. But the guy that we caught on the stand, he was very credible. And in fact, coming out of his deposition, had I not read his transcript from the other case that one of my co-defendants found, I will not take credit. I didn't find the transcript. The other guy did the legwork and found it. And we took this guy's deposition, and my co-defendant came to me right before the deposition because I was the one asking the majority of the questions. He's like, hey, I got to show you this. And I'm like, oh my God, this is gold. And I actually was going to pull it out in the deposition. He's like, don't. Let's hold. Let's wait to see if this goes to trial. If it goes to trial, we're going to put it in front of the judge. But I had in my, I took the page from the case, because it was actually a reported case, And I had the five, they took the exact five questions that were asked and reported in the case, and I asked them in the exact same way in the deposition. And then I repeated those questions at the trial. And what happened was, I got there, and I had the plaintiff had him put his testimony out there, blah, 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 they designed this, blah, 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 blah. And I said, okay, so let me see if I got this understood. I took your deposition, Mr. Expert, and him, I can't remember his name. So the other guy I remember vividly, but I won't mention Bob's name, but I can't remember this other guy's name. So I remember, you remember our deposition? Yeah. Remember we talked about this? That's what you testified in this other case, or in your case earlier today. Yeah. So this is what you believe. This is your opinion as an expert, the standard, so forth and so on. Yes. I said, okay. And I said, do you remember such and such a case? And he's like, well, I've been in a lot of cases, Mr. Haney. And I said, well, it was in 1984, whatever the year was. And I said, do you remember that you testified as an expert? He's like, well, I think it's possible. I'm like, do you remember me asking you this question in the deposition? And I repeat it. I have my transcript from the deposition. I ask this question, and I go, and he's like, well, I don't remember specifically. I said, well, let me read it to you. And I asked the question, and I said, do you remember giving this answer? And I read into the record what his answer was. And he's like, okay, yeah, that's what the record says. They said, so in this case, do you remember being asked this question? It was the exact same question. And I go, and he's like, no, I don't remember. And I'm like, well, it's in the transcript from that case. So was that the same question I asked before you? And he's like, seems like it. So do you remember giving this answer? And I did it five times. And by the fifth time, he's like, you don't need to read it anymore. I know what you're doing, Mr. Haney. And I'm like, well, let me just read it to the record anyway. And then I didn't. Then I was done. Like, that's all I needed to do. I didn't talk about anything else about his opinions. I didn't give him a chance to talk about anything else. I just went up and said, we took your deposition. I asked you these five questions. You gave me these five answers. Here are these five questions. Here are these five answers. And then I just sat down. Because by that time, it didn't matter what he said. It didn't matter. The judge was like, you're just a paid expert. So, Does that answer your question whether he was just a bad expert? Okay, yeah. Had he not done that, he probably would have been pretty good, but he just, you know. So whether he loses credibility for future cases kind of depends on what his peers say and how this, if this gets out. You know, my suspicion is he wasn't out telling people when he got back to the office what happened. What's interesting is he had a partner. I've done a lot of arbitrations and mediations, but I've only had, like, you don't get to trial very often in this day and age because trial is so expensive and so risky. So this series of questions to this expert and the other expert, whose first name was Eddie, and I don't remember his last name, was like my most fun day ever being a lawyer because it just felt like I was on TV. So I did the first guy, and I completely just asked those five questions and made him look bad. And I will be honest, I didn't, like I said, I didn't find the case, and the guy who found the case, I said to him before trial, and his name was Mike as well, I go, Mike, do you want this? Because this is, you found this. I'm like, this is going to be fun. He's like, no, hey, you do it. Like, I don't know why, but I got to do it, so I got the fun part. And I had done all the research on this other guy. The other guy, Eddie, came up, and I had actually worked with Eddie in another case when I was at a different firm where he was assisting my case. Now, I had worked with him very peripherally, and I was a young associate, so I knew him. He didn't remember me, and he mostly worked with a partner. And I frankly don't know if he did a good job or bad. He came from actually one of the best forensic architectural investigation firms in the country. So he was highly qualified. Both of these guys were highly qualified and very credible firms, which I won't name. And I hire this firm all the time. So it's, in fact, I have a case right now with one of these guys' former partners. He's working with them from the same firm. So they can continue work. But anyway, Eddie gets up on the stand, and he had all these calculations of where the loads were and this and that, and I had run his calculations after his deposition. I looked at his report, and he had like four major math errors. And so I got him on the stand, and I said, Mr. Like I said, I don't remember his last name. Eddie. I'll just call him Eddie because that's his first name. I'm like, so you did this calculation, and all I wanted to do was have him admit that these were his numbers and he ran the calculation. But he was so cocky, and he came before I had already, he was before the other guy, because he was the junior and then the senior guy. So he hadn't already seen some problems with his case. So he's very cocky, and he actually said, and this is where you got to be careful when you're an expert of being too cocky in the stand. He's like, look, the computer program we use is more sophisticated than the computers they use at NASA to put the man on the moon. Like, so you did the math here. You did these calculations with this program that is better than what you can use to put the man on the moon. Is that what you're telling me? And he said, yes. And he was like, yes. So proud of it. And then I showed him his five math errors. I was like, do you really think you're going to put a man on the moon with your program? Like, he just looked like an idiot. And like I said, it was my most fun day ever as being a lawyer, because he walked into it himself about saying how great he was, and I just had these five math errors that I just showed his rocket ship computer could do. And then the next guy got up, and we just, that was like I said, the most fun I ever had as a lawyer. So, anyway. All right, enough of the war stories. Let's get back to this so we can get you guys out of class. Okay, so here it says, occasionally a layman can determine a professional's conduct violates appropriate standard of care. So like here, if a doctor injects poison into a patient's vein, well, you know, you don't need an expert to say the doctor shouldn't be injecting poison. Or if you, kind of the more famous cases where they closed up your stomach and they left an instrument in there, and there's an X-ray. You know, here's an X-ray of the clamp or the cloth or the tweezers or whatever. You don't need an expert to say that they violated standard care. So the layman can actually say that. The average person says, "Yeah, I don't think you should be leaving a scalpel in someone's stomach or whatever it is." So that's something you can do. And then the last one here that's important for standard of care with professional. And this goes a little bit to your question of whether this expert was a good expert or bad, is the qualifications of that expert. So the guy that I was able to discredit with the opposite opinions was actually a very qualified expert based on his education and his history and the firm for which he worked and so forth and so on. He just was a liar, and that got him in trouble. Or maybe not a liar, but he would take any opinion that would pay his bills. But you can have a situation where the expert could be of the same profession but is not qualified. So I'll give you an example of that in a case that I was in about 2 years or 3 years ago. So this is this pump case. And as I said, once the pump started operating at a certain speed, there was this vibration, and it had to do with the geometry of the tank at which it was sitting and the way the connections were, how the pump was mounted. It sits on a little crown at the bottom of the tank, and it's supposed to be freestanding, and it's supposed to spin things around. But sometimes if it's not stable, you know, think about a top. Like when the top is spinning, but if it's not quite, it'll wobble a little bit. It'll go off. And so that's what was happening with this pump. You know, obviously I'm not a pump designer, but that was the layman's term. But once the wobble started happening with this big pump, and just for your understanding, the pump is about 14 feet tall, sitting in a tank that's probably 25 feet wide in diameter. So it's not some small little thing in your backyard. So this huge pump, rotating at hundreds of thousands of RPMs, the pump hundreds of thousands of gallons, and if it's off kilter, off axis, it's going to create some vibration, or depending on where the geometry is, the water, and it's going to resonate back and forth, and it creates, in this case, a harmonic resonance. It actually, the sound of it, as opposed to the waves of the water, became more damaging, at least my expert said, to the pump, and that's why the pump vibrated and fell apart, and we had to replace it and replace it 8 times, and we never got it right. The expert on the other side they brought in was an engineer and had designed water treatment plants, so presumably qualified, but he had never had any opinion, or he had never testified, nor had he done any research, nor had he had any schooling or education on resonance, on harmonic resonance. And so what we were able to do in his deposition was we were able to get him to do two things. One, we were able to make him opine, and this was based on his written opinions as well, that the vibrations were the primary cause. And we're going through this negligence standard, although this is a breach of contract, but the cause of the damage, the cause of the pump falling apart, was caused by the vibrations. And the vibrations were due to a breach of the contractual obligation to design properly. So we said the primary proximate cause is the vibration. But then I got him to admit that he'd never been a vibration expert, that he'd never testified about vibration, and he never studied vibration. So when we got ready to go to trial, I filed a motion to disqualify him to testify about vibrations. He could testify anything he wanted about the water treatment plant, about anything else about the design, because he was qualified for that. But I got him barred from testifying about the vibrations. And that's an issue where the qualifications of the expert to opine on the standard of care is important. And there's all these cases about what's qualified, and you go through this certain type of analysis, and so when they're on the stand, you have to ask specific questions, and then the court will ultimately make the decision as to whether this expert's qualified and you can move on if you get all the way to trial. Sometimes you try to head it off to the pass, but which we did, which we tried to do. We never got to trial, so the final decision was never made. But the qualifications are very important because that expert's going to hold higher esteem. The jury's going to look at that expert and say, well, this guy, he's the expert. He's going to tell me what, he or she's going to tell me what's the issue. So you want to make sure that you prove that they're qualified or that there's checks and balances on whether that expert's qualified. Okay. Moving on. Okay. Second element, breach or dereliction of the duty. Breach of duty, dereliction of the duty. It's pretty simple. Whatever your duty was, you failed to do it. You fell short of it. And the question is, there's this reasonable person test. Was the conduct of that individual, the defendant in this case, did they act not such as the reasonable person would have acted in that situation? And reasonable, this is that reasonable, prudent, ordinary person, if it's an ordinary guy or woman, or if it's in the profession, as a second bullet here, is it the reasonable, prudent architect, the reasonable engineer? Was it reasonable for the doctor not to administer care to the person lying on the street? Yes, for the reasons we talked about. When we're in the actions and we're performing the design, is it reasonable for the architect when designing a house that they didn't put in 100% filtration system? Yes, because a house normally doesn't have the same filtration standards as a hospital might. So what's reasonable? And if you fail, so that the standard, if you breach that duty, the question is, did that person act reasonably? If they acted reasonably, they didn't breach it. If they didn't act reasonably, if they didn't act the way that reasonable person would have done, they did breach that standard of care. Does that make sense? Okay. Causation. So we talked a little about proximate cause. So here's what this is. So the plaintiff, the claimant, party that's injured, must prove the defendant's breach of the standard of care. So we got that first standard and the breach. We got those first two knocked out. Was the proximate cause of the injuries. It's both an actual cause and not too distant in that causal chain. So car accident. I ran the red light and hit a car. My running the red light was the breach of my duty to follow the traffic rules. And that running the red light, that breach of that duty, caused me, plus my negligence in driving, not looking around, caused me to run into you because you were in the intersection legally. That was the proximate cause. Now, it doesn't have to be the only cause of the injury. So let's say you're driving and you don't have your seatbelt on. Well, you clearly were injured because you got hit by the car. Now, you had your own problems because you didn't have your seatbelt on, so your injuries may have been much greater. That comes into another layer when we get into damages and defenses as to whether you're entitled to a defense, whether you can make a defense to that claim against you. But that causation, your action, your defendant's action, does not need to be the only cause, but it has to be a proximate cause. And if it's sufficient, if that cause results in an injury. So there has to be this causal nexus. And then also, when you're looking at it, this whole concept of reasonableness comes in as well. Whether or not there's that cause is proximate is whether the results of your actions were reasonable. So if you're driving and you run a red light, of course the results of you running that red light, it's reasonable to foresee that you could hit someone. Your failure to properly design, because obviously running a red light, as you can see, you can understand that, but if you did a negligent design, it's reasonable to believe that if you didn't design that wall properly, that it would fall over and injure someone. And so that's that question that the jury, again, once again, is going to be asked for this element. Was the action or failure to act, in the design, it's often the failure to act. I didn't design it to snow load, so I failed to do something as opposed to I intentionally didn't design a snow load. But was that act the proximate cause? Was my failure? And the jury is going to look at that. The jury's going to weigh the evidence. They're going to hear what the standard is. They're going to hear what the expert says. And they're going to weigh the facts as they come in. They're going to say, yes, it was reasonably foreseeable that the injury that the party's claiming was proximately caused by your actions. Now, the other thing you can look at it real simply is the but-for test. But for the defendant's action, negligent act or omission, would I have suffered injury? If I'm driving down the street and I don't have my seatbelt on, probably not going to suffer injury if nobody hits me. Now, if I myself careen out and run into a telephone pole, I'm going to cause injury. And maybe I'm driving through the intersection and I see you because you ran the red light and I swerve and I hit the telephone pole, so I never was hit by you. Clearly, the telephone pole and me hitting into it is the proximate cause of the injury, but was my actions reasonable based on you coming through the intersection because you ran the red light, that could have also been the proximate cause? And that's where the jury weighs. Maybe I ran a red light, but maybe I was going 2 miles an hour in the swerve because the other guy was speeding. All those things kind of come into a factor of whether it's reasonable and but for me running the light, would I have been injured? Who knows? That's some of the questions. So, and this then comes into this question, can there be a break between your action by a superseding or intervening cause of action? So if I go through the intersection, and maybe I'm just rolling through the intersection, maybe what happens is I'm stopped at the red light and traffic is moving and somebody's coming through and I roll that because I'm anticipating the red light to go, but I don't enter into the intersection. And the party that's driving through swerves quickly and runs into that telephone pole. You can make an argument that they're swerving, even though you were actually moving and you should have been at a full stop. Their intervention was not reasonable, and it was an intervening cause. And so therefore, that superseding or intervening cause breaks that causal link. And my rolling just a little bit was not the causal, proximate cause to the accident. So, criminal actions or intentional torts can break the chain, or like an unforeseeable act of God. You know, there's a flood, there's tornado or whatever. Maybe you designed the building and the flood came in. Well, yes, you designed the building improperly. Maybe you were negligent in whether the wall was going to stand up. But if a flood comes in and knocks the wall down, and that flood would have knocked any wall down, yes, your actions were negligent, but the superseding action came in and really caused the injury. It broke the chain. My design was negligent. I failed to perform into the standard of care. I breached it. But the wall fell down because of the flood, not because of my negligence. So there was this intervening incident that broke the chain. So I was not the proximate cause of the injury. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, damages. So now you got somebody that's injured. What do you do? Damages, just like in breach of contract, they're intended to compensate the injured party for all injuries suffered. So you got hurt. Someone took your property. Someone converted and stole your car. Whatever it might be, you need to be compensated for that tort. So here's some examples of typical traditional tort claims. Lost wages, you can't go to work. So you got to get the time, you know, you're recuperating. So whatever your money you should have been paid, you got to get lost wages. And sometimes it could be so bad, like, you know, if a worker loses a limb, they can never work again. Interestingly enough, one of my former partners, probably one of the smartest guys I've ever met, he grew up and was kind of a, not kind of, he was a rabble-rouser. My wife would probably laugh at me if I said the word rabble-rouser. He was a troublemaker. He got in trouble a lot in high school, didn't like authority, and at the day he turned 18, he walked out of his house and he's like, screw it to everybody. He went to go work in construction. And that's all he wanted to do, work in construction. And he got on, but he was smart. So he started as a carpenter, started working locally. He actually built railroad tracks for a while. Then he started building buildings. And then he and his wife moved out to out west, and they started building high-rises. And he put himself on as a foreman and a superintendent because he was smart and everything else. And then he got injured. He got injured badly. His hand was injured. And so he was unable to work for, I think, 8 or 10 months. And so as a result, he got his GED or a high school degree, I'm not sure which, but he took some college classes. And tried to go back and work some more, but he couldn't because of the injury to his hand. He couldn't move, and the feeling in his hands, he was unable to work. So he got paid for the lost wages of when he was injured. Why I want to tell you a story is, interestingly enough, he actually enjoyed college, went to college out there. His wife was working, so she helped support their little baby. Did great in college, got himself to Harvard, went to Harvard Law School, and is now one of the most successful lawyers I ever met, because he got injured on a construction accident. Like, he's like, Mike, had I not injured my hand hanging on the side of the building, I would have been doing that the rest of my life. But because of that, it changed the course of his life. But he had an action. He got lost wages. He got the value, cost of repair, replacement of the damage, maybe to your injury. There's in some things, there's workers' comp where a hand or a thumb or an arm or whatever is worth some money. They have a certain value, and then you go for a lawsuit. You know, like you hear about people recovering lots of money for injuries and things like that. So you get costs for the loss repair. And if it's damage to property, if somebody crashes into your car, you get money to fix the car. So that's a tort to your car, effectively. And you get money for that. And then the other area you can get cash for is for pain and suffering, and that's like mental anguish and things like that. So, as you know, from reading the news, personal injury can be in the millions of dollars. And then the design defects can cost hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to repair. That's the stuff that I deal with, and that's where you guys are going to be. Well, hopefully you're never in that instance, but if you're in a case, you're going to be dealing with lots and lots of money to repair the buildings that are not properly performed. Last point I hear, I'm not going to put a question in the exam, but I wanted to raise this concept here called betterment. Going back to my pump case, what ended up happening in that case is our pump kept vibrating and didn't work. We offered a solution, but by the time that we provided what we think would have been the solution to fix it, the owner, it was actually a city, a municipality, they decided to hire an entirely new engineering firm, and they redesigned the entire water treatment plant. And for lack of better description, what was designed and supplied for them was like a Chevy. And what they brought the new expert in that was designed and built for them was like a Cadillac. So our system, us and the pumps and working with the other things, was about a $600,000 to $800,000 system. The new one they installed was $2.2 million. And so we made an argument in defense of their damages of what's called betterment. What they got was better than what they contractually were supposed to get. You contracted for a Chevy, it didn't work, you're entitled for a lawsuit for the cost of a new Chevy, not for the cost of a Cadillac, because a Cadillac is better than a Chevy. Maybe some people don't think that, but, you know, as far as the types of cars, but you can do, you know, a Mercedes or a Rolls Royce as opposed to a Chevy, but you can't get something more than what you contracted for. That's some contractual issues in betterment. You're not going to get betterment in the damages world when you don't have to worry about betterment in a simple breach of contract or a tort claim, but in construction and in damages, you can get betterment issues here. So, okay, next. So I talked about there could be defenses that maybe the plaintiff's own actions, and I gave this example of the plaintiff swerving in the car. Now the states are split. It's a minority majority, but the states are split between two theories of how to share the fault. And so what I would say is if I'm the party who was being sued, I'm going to say, okay, yes, I may have committed negligence, but the plaintiff was negligent as well. And depending on what state I'm in, I may have a complete defense, that's contributory negligence, or I may have a partial defense, that's comparative negligence. So let's talk about contributory negligence. So contributory negligence started from centuries ago. The king would look at you and say, okay, yeah, yes, they did wrong to you, but you had a little bit of wrong, you get nothing. It's still in four states plus the District of Columbia. Alabama, Maryland, North Carolina, Virginia. So some old school eastern states and D.C. And it's pretty harsh. And what it says is that if you as the plaintiff, the party who was injured, had any responsibility, any of your own negligence, even as small as 1%, you get zero recovery. So, if I'm not acting 100% properly, let's say I'm walking down the street and I'm walking across an intersection and there's a don't walk sign and I shouldn't walk. And the cars are coming through, and I take one step out before it turns to walk. And there's another car coming through that intersection and clearly runs the red light because I've stepped out now and hits me. There's an argument to be made because I stepped out early. I was negligent myself, that in a contributory negligence state, I would get zero recovery, even though we can show that the other side ran the red light. That's a pure contributory negligence state. Now, some states, they apply either what's called the last chance or last clear chance rule or gross negligence. So could the defendant, even if the plaintiff was themselves negligent, could I have acted somehow to avoid the injury? Could I have swerved? If I had the last clear chance, even though the plaintiff stepped out in the street one step early, the plaintiff could potentially still recover. Or if I was grossly negligent, if it was clear that I was going to run right, and in fact I accelerated to get through that because I saw it yellow and I wanted to get through because I was late getting home for dinner, that I was grossly negligent as opposed to just negligent, that could be a mitigating factor in the contributory negligence state. But not many, so it's pretty harsh. But the rest of the states, and Illinois is one of them, there's what's called comparative negligence. So the comparative negligence claim, the jury is charged to give you a portion of the fault. And the dollars that are paid are related to that. So let's say I get injured and the jury says the value of my injury is $1 million. I lost a leg, it's worth $1 million between my lost wages and pain and suffering and all those other stuff. But then they're required to say, did I, as the party was injured, did I have any of my own fault in that? And they attribute that because of the way I was acting, climbing the ladder when I fell and injured myself, even though it was a defective ladder, and I was goofing around, but I was 18% liable. I had my own 18%. Well, the $1 million claim, or the $1 million jury verdict, the judgment, is then reduced by my 18%. So I get paid $1 million based on their calculations. I get paid $820,000. I have an 18% reduction. That's a comparative negligence analysis. Does that make sense? I'm sorry, explain that again. What was your question again? No, I could hear you. I just didn't understand what you meant. Oh, okay. So the question is, how does a jury decide on the percentages when they're back in the jury room on who is what percentage? You know, so you got an owner, you got an architect, you got a contractor, and you got the injured worker. So you got four parties there. And all parties put in their testimony. The owner's like, hey, man, I just paid the bills. I was never there. I didn't do anything. And the architect said, well, I designed it, and it was just a crappy building, and so here's all the reasons why the contractor did the wrong construction. It's their fault. And the contractor comes in and says, look, I built it the way they designed it. I didn't deviate at all. And oh, by the way, the owner was never giving me enough information, and he was always pushing me, and they're all pointing fingers at each other, and all this testimony comes in. And then the jury goes back in the room, and they make soup, and they figure out how the soup is made. And the answer to the question is, how does the jury figure out the portions? You're going to have to ask each and every jury how they did that. There is no specific rule. You can put together jury instructions, but it's going to be them sitting around a table, a gut action. They're going to say, the plaintiff was goofing around, and I think it was worth a quarter of it, or worth a tenth of it, or worth 18%. You just don't know. And it's kind of funny when you actually pool juries afterwards, and you start talking to them. I would say in 95% of the time, when you talk to the jurors after the case, they will have focused on things entirely different than you thought were the most important things in the case. And so you may emphasize facts A, B, and C, and you think that's going to get you, you know, going to transfer 100% liability to the contractor or whatever it is. And they may listen to C, D, and F and say, well, yeah, I saw C, but I didn't think A and B were important. And so you never really know. So unfortunately, the answer is, how did the jury decide? And what's the? It's just them sitting around at a table talking and writing down a number. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why, if you have a big case, a big bet the company case, a big dollar case, that's why they encourage you to get a jury, to get mock juries to actually put on portions of your trial before you go to trial, because you learn as you're presenting the evidence what they listen to is entirely different. Like I may have a case where I've focused on three things that are really important. The jury's like, oh, those didn't mean anything to me. So that's either the beauty or the negative of our system is there are 12 people in a room and they're going to figure it out on their own. So any other questions on that? One last point, this last thing, in this pure comparative state, 50%, so you are going to have some states that say if you're 50% or greater, or even 51, Hawaii and Iowa, for whatever reason, say 51%, if the plaintiff is 50% greater, or in those two states, 51% greater in their fault, they get zero. So, a pure comparative says, we're just going to take percentage across the board. We're going to take $1 million and we're going to divide it up into what your percentages are. And if the plaintiff is 75% liable, they're still going to get $250,000. That's your pure comparative. Modified comparative is 50%. If the plaintiff is 50% or more, they're going to get nothing. So it kind of takes a little bit of the contributory in, but you have to be at least 50%. Or in Hawaii or Iowa, it's 51% or more. So just a couple little nuances, but most states are pure compared. Or most states, actually, I believe most states are more than modified as far as the 50%. But I'm not 100% on it. But I think most of them are the modified 50% rule. So okay. So we've done a lot. We've gone through all the elements. We've had, and this is where I hope the sound works because I got a little video clip for you. So we got the duty, the breach of duty, the proximate cause, and the injury or the damage. This is a clip from my youth. My favorite architect of the world, which I talked about, I believe, in my first lecture, Mike Brady. Is the sound working? All right. So, what happened there? Well, we had a duty, the duty for Mrs. Brady to drive carefully. And the plaintiff alleged that she breached her duty. Now, she said she didn't, but she alleged she breached her duty. But the plaintiff here also had a duty to pull out of the parking lot properly, to not breach his duty. And he said he did. So we have this competing thing, and the judge here, because there was no jury, was both the trier of fact and the trier of law. And we have, presumably, the proximate cause. There was a little magnetic chalkboard there that had the little cars on it, and obviously Mrs. Brady, when he pulled out of his parking space, hit him. So there's your car accident. And the damage was his injury to his neck. So we have the four elements: the duty to drive safely, the breach of duty by Mrs. Brady for not driving safely because she hit the car, the proximate cause because the car accident, it was foreseeable that if she was not properly driving, she would hit the car, and the injury or the damage to the individual. That's your four elements. Our hero, Mike Brady, the architect, throws his briefcase out there because he thinks the guy's faking, and when the briefcase drops, the injured party is able to move his neck. And the court says, you don't have a damage, even though that's not what they say in the language of the clip. So we don't have a full negligence claim. There is no injury. He was a malingerer. He was taking advantage of the situation. Now, it's possible even that if we look at it a little bit further, the court might say, I don't even believe your testimony of whether you, Mr. Duggan, was operating properly. But that's your scenario where we have seemingly all the elements, and one of them doesn't fall and doesn't make it for the trier of fact. So that's the decision of the court. All right. Last couple slides. Contribution and indemnity. So I'm raising this just so you guys can see it. Indemnity is very, very, very important in the construction world. And I'm not going to have any detailed questions on indemnity because it can get very complex. I will tell you this. I would say, and no disrespect to my brother, but many lawyers don't understand indemnity very well. So I'm not going to expect you guys to understand the nuances and everything else, but it's very important in the world of construction. And kind of going back to things you always want to have in your construction contract and your architectural agreement, is you want to have indemnification. So what is indemnity? It's a contractual obligation. There is common law indemnity, but we're only going to just look here for purposes of this slide. It's a contractual obligation, so it's in a contract, of one party, the indemnitor they're called, or the indemnifier, to compensate the loss incurred to the other party, the indemnity, due to the acts of the indemnitor or the other party. Well, what the hell does that mean? That's a lot of this legal mumbo-jumbo. Okay, what it means is, in parlance to you guys, you're an architect, and you have a duty to perform in accordance to the standard of care. You enter into a contract with the owner to design the house. In the course of those designs, there's a defect. You aren't designing properly, so you have breached your duty. However, under indemnification, there has to be a third party. So someone else is injured, not the owner. It's not the wall falling down on the owner. The owner may have a different claim against you, but a third party is injured. And they sue the owner. So maybe due to the defects in your house, the owner gets injured. Maybe the wall falls down on the injured party. Now, the homeowner that's hired you can bring a claim against to repair the wall. That's a breach of contract action. But let's say the owner is sued by the neighbor who's hurt by the injured wall. Well, the owner's like, I didn't have anything to do with it. But the injured party is allowed to recover from the owner because it's the owner's property, it's the owner's wall. And so what happens is the owner has a loss. Obviously, the third party has a loss, but the owner would have a loss. And you, as the architect, need to indemnify the owner for your acts that caused that third party to be injured. So if the lawsuit is only against the owner may bring you in on an indemnity claim, And if you fail to pay, and say, you have to pay. What I have to pay the plaintiff, you have to pay me. You need to indemnify me. Or what normally happens in the lawsuit is you end up paying directly to the, because everybody gets brought in, you pay directly to the plaintiff, or to the injured party, the plaintiff. So that's what it is. And so there's this third party that's involved in indemnity. It's never going to be what's called a first party claim. A first party claim is the two parties in the contract. An indemnity comes in when it's a tort claim and it's a third party who has no contract with either of the people in the action, but they have been injured. So they bring a negligence claim. I got injured because a wall fell on me. I don't know whose fault it was, contractor, owner, or architect, but I got injured and I should be compensated for it. The owner is going to say to the contractor and the architect, hey, if it was your fault, if you built it wrong, you designed it wrong, you need to indemnify me for that. So it's the security against a loss or damage that I, the homeowner, would face because it's my home that the wall fell on the guy. Does that make sense on that high level? The reason why I want you to understand just this part of it, and I have a couple more slides that get in a little more complexity, but I want to tell you about them, but the reason why I want you to understand this part of it is because obviously, in the construction industry, injuries can happen all the time. And more importantly, though, is the majority of the injuries that happen in the course of a construction project, you are not in contract with that party. The only person you as the architect are in contract with is the owner. The only person that the contractor is in contract with is the owner. So anybody else that's injured, any other injury, creates a cause of action for negligence. Contractor was negligent. The owner was negligent. The architect was negligent. Who else? Somebody else is negligent. But that injured party doesn't have a contract against you, so they have to bring this tort. And if they only sue the homeowner, the property owner, or only the one party, that one party can look to you and say, it's not my fault, it's your fault, you need to indemnify me for that third party claim. Where I get into problems, you need to have an indemnity clause in every one of your construction contracts, and often the owner's not going to give you indemnity, but sometimes you should ask for it. But certainly, if you're helping your owner negotiate the construction contract, you can help them and say, not only should the contractor indemnify you, but the contractor should indemnify me. So let's take that same scenario where the wall falls down on this next-door neighbor. And the next-door neighbor decides, oh, I found out who the architect is. I'm going to sue the architect in tort. The architect's like, I designed it fine, but the party's injured. So you need to be able to say the contractor should indemnify me for that. So you want, as the architect, when you're putting together the owner-contractor agreement, to say, owner, make sure the contractor indemnifies you and me as the architect. That's all that you guys really need to know for purposes just of understanding indemnity. But it's very important because that's where lots and lots of the lawsuits come in. And they don't have to necessarily even be based on a personal injury. It could be property damages. It could be a fine let's say that there's toxic fumes being put into the atmosphere. There could be fines and indemnity because they're being fined by a federal government. That's a third party. So there's some other issues that come in. Okay. Two things else about indemnity and contribution, or indemnity also is contribution. Contribution is like indemnity, but you actually bring into the trial this third party to say, yes, it could be my fault, but it's this party's fault as well. So you are a contributor to the person's injury. So let's say we have a case where the owner gets sued and the architect gets sued by this party, this individual, the next door neighbor who got the wall filled on him. But the owner, the injured neighbor doesn't know who the contractor was, so they don't sue him. So the owner then brings in the contractor on a contribution claim and an indemnity claim. We'll have two claims and say, you contributed to the fault, and you need to indemnify me if I have to pay. So, that's this concept here. Contribution statutory, it happens in construction claims all the time, so I just want you to know that this exists. So if you ever brought into a third-party claim and there's an injured party and then somebody says, oh, we got brought in under contribution, that's what's happening here, or I'm supposed to identify. So I just want you to kind of understand that that's an example of contribution that would come in. And then finally, contractual indemnity, as I said, there can be common law indemnity, but here we have contractual indemnity. And so the reason why is that you can make a party a promise, and any promise to a contract, and so you're going to put into your contract, I, architect, promise to indemnify owner, or subcontractor. I, subcontractor, promise to indemnify contractor, or contractor, promise to indemnify owner, architect. So you kind of think about it, contractually what's going to happen is the person that normally is going to be paying your bill, the one that's paying you to do work, you're going to indemnify them, kind of go upstream. It doesn't go downstream often. Like normally I have, unless under very specific circumstances, I don't have an owner indemnify a contractor. But generally it's an upstream one, whoever's paying. Okay, that's it for today. Any questions? All right, last thing. Go ahead. That's a great question. So that's a great question. The two questions, and actually, you actually asked kind of a two-part question. Does the indemnity remove the liability of the other party, and could it remove the liability maybe even downstream, like if it's a subcontractor that indemnifies the contractor, does it remove the contractor's, or upstream, does it remove the contractor's potential liability? So that's kind of two parts. So the answer to that, in simple terms, is no. And in fact, what you will see in a good indemnity clause, it'll say, I architect, agree to defend, indemnify, and hold harmless owner, its agents, blah, 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 you know, its office, employees, et cetera, et cetera. So you have this indemnity language. And then there's some other things explaining what a claim is and kind of some more detail of it. And then the final sentence will say, notwithstanding the above, this indemnity obligation shall not remove liability of someone for their own negligence. So it says, if you have some negligence, I must indemnify you, but it doesn't mean you get off scot-free. So let's take the example of the wall falling on the neighbor. If the owner, if it was designed improperly or built improperly, but the owner contributed to that by having poor upkeep on the wall and saw that there were problems and didn't go do anything to mitigate it and saw that the wall was falling down, and it does fall down, you can make the argument that the owner had some liability there because they left the wall to deteriorate, didn't do anything, and they saw it and they knew it was going to fall down. In addition to the architect saying, yeah, I may have designed it improperly, but that's a superseding cause, your negligence in the upkeep of the wall, the architect's going to say, if the jury finds me partially negligent, they assign me 35%, but they assign you 20%, I don't have to indemnify you for that 20%. You have to pick up the 20% yourself. So I'm only indemnifying for what I'm negligent for, and you don't get a pass. So that's what's between you and the owner. Now, the second part of your question is, what happens if the wall falls down because it's a construction defect and the general contractor doesn't do the actual work? It's a brick mason, and the brick mason's the subcontractor. So the brick mason indemnifies the contractor for the contract for its work. So the brick maker says, if I screw up in my work, you, contractor, I'm going to indemnify you for that. Then the party gets sued, whether it's the owner, and the owner says, contractor, indemnify me, because it's only contractually indemnified. The contractor still owes indemnity to the owner because of their contract, because that language will say, I'm indemnifying for all of my actions and the actions of my subcontractor. So if, and that's where this contribution thing comes in, that's when you bring the subcontractor in. So what happens is, the wall falls down, the architect's not part of this, then the owner didn't do anything wrong. So if the wall falls down and it's 100% contractor's fault, the owner looks to the contractor to pay the $1 million jury verdict. If the contractor had 10% fault because it improperly did site supervision, and it should have some fault because it's managing what the subcontractors do, simply because the subcontractor is agreed to indemnify the contractor, and simply because the wall was built 100% by the subcontractor, doesn't mean that the general contractor gets out. So the owner says, I have a contractual indemnity with you, contractor. Somehow you got to get the $1 million to pay to this plaintiff. I don't care how you get it, but you figure it out. And then when the jury does the apportionment, 10%, 90%, do the way the indemnity works, 90% is going to be paid by the brick mason and 10% is going to be paid by the contractor. So simply because someone's indemnifying you doesn't get you out of your potential negligence based on the language in the what you should have in your contractual indemnity clause. Now, there's one little nuance to that, because the law is very complicated and always has one other twist. If you forget to put that sentence in that clause that says a party will not be indemnified for its own negligence, meaning if you have some negligence, you don't get any free pass there. If you fail to put that sentence in your construction contract, many states have statutorily made that the law, but not all. So Minnesota is one of those, where if you forget to put in that a party cannot be held liable for its own, or cannot be indemnified for its own negligence, if you forget to put that in a contract in Minnesota, then my scenario where contractors 10% and subcontractors 90%, subcontractor pays it all because they forgot to put it in, so that allocation doesn't come down because the contractor is indemnified 100% by the subcontractor. So in that sense, the subcontractor is indemnifying the contract for everything, including its own negligence. So there's a couple of nuances, some states. So the long and the short of it is, you need to have an indemnity clause in the contract. You need to make sure it allocates who's indemnifying whom for what. And you need to make sure you have this sentence that says, no party shall be indemnified for their own negligence. Correct. So the question was, yes, that's correct. The question was, does the owner have more of an incentive to have an indemnity clause so they can effectively pass that negligence downstream? And the answer is yes. And you want to think about it, not just the owner, you want to think about it, any party who has a contract with someone downstream from them. So owner to architect, there should be an indemnity clause there. Architect to his mechanical engineer, there should be one. Mechanical engineer to his specialty HVAC guy in that one part should have one. So going downstream, if anybody you contract to do services that are part of your scope, you should do that because you never know if the injured party is going to sue just you or everybody. And lots of times, when the wall falls on the neighbor, he just sues his next-door neighbor. And if it's just the next-door neighbor, and the jury hears that the wall fell down, the jury and there's an injury, and there's $1 million, he's dead, or whatever, the bad injury, the jury's going to award money. And if there's nobody else in the action, and there's no other indemnity, then the homeowner is going to pay that $1 million. So that party that's at the top of the contractual chain, it's important for them to get that indemnity And that's why it's so important in construction, because there's so many things that can go wrong that you need to have, and frankly, any type of business, contract or otherwise, but construction, because that's what I do, it's so important for you to have indemnity clauses to make sure they properly allocate who's responsible to whom for what, and that they have this kind of catch-all language at the end. And on that, at the end of the class, end of the semester, you will get a fully loaded, fully baked owner-architect agreement that has all of these clauses and everything you need. You can use it, you can take it to your boss, you can take it when you open your own business, that's architect-sided. But if you guys want to use, you can use or whatever, and I will walk through each one of those. So you don't have to remember what exactly they are. You can, when you get out in practice, you can wave this contract around and say, this is the one I want to do my designs with. So that'll be available for you. Yeah, so the question is whether you want to have the, is there a reason why the architect would not want to have an indemnity clause providing indemnification to the owner? And of course, the answer is, if you could put together if you look at a kind of some basic, even, I want to check, well, even the B101. So the B101 we're going to go through tomorrow, or next, in 2 weeks. It's written by the American Institute of Architects. There is not an indemnity clause, I don't believe, I can't remember, I think there's one in the owner-contractor agreement. I don't believe there's one in the owner-architect agreement, because the architects don't want to provide indemnity to the owner. And if you put together your own form, if you go to work and somebody hires you to design services for you, I would recommend that you provide them a contract that does not have an indemnity contract upstream. Now, if they ask for one, it's hard-pressed for you to say no, and you can ask for mutual indemnity. Well, if I'm going to indemnify you, you indemnify me, and therefore, if the owner has some type of fault, they indemnify you for that, as opposed to just one way. So, yes, if an architect can get into a contract without offering indemnity to someone, they should do that. But rarely are you going to see a construction contract that doesn't have one in there, and so that's why it's important when I say you need to make sure it properly allocates for whom it does to what. And the other thing is one of the roles you guys are going to do, so you may negotiate contracts for your firm someday in your careers or not, but you're always going to be working with owners. And in fact, you will probably see more contracts that are the owner-contractor agreements in your course of your career than you will see owner-architect agreements. What's going to happen is there's going to be one or two people at your firm or their outside counsel that's going to negotiate the agreement between the owner and the architect, your employer or your company. But you are going to be representing the owner all the time and helping them sign up contractors. So that's why when you are dealing with this, you need to understand it, because you need to say to the owner, don't enter into a contract, owner, with this contractor unless the contractor is indemnifying you. So that's the reason why you need to understand that it's this risk-shifting obligation, third-party claims, and like I said, I'll get you guys the language ultimately when we get there. So, anything else? Okay, guys, I will see you next week. I sent out, by the way, I sent out a Zoom link for the end of the semester, so I got responses back. There were some people that said they didn't mind either way. I don't think there was anybody that specifically says, yes, I want to come downtown on Friday mornings. That's the only way I want to do it. But there were enough of you guys that due to both logistics and personal beliefs and health issues and all the things that make entirely good sense to me, have requested that we're going to do Zoom through the rest of the semester, and I'm fine with that, so we'll be doing it from here. I'm sad I won't be able to meet you guys in person. Maybe we'll figure out somehow to do that when it gets a little warmer. I don't know what we can do, because obviously I like to meet you guys, but we will, based on the class and everything, we'll do Zoom for the rest of the semester. So, okay? All right. Thanks, guys. Have a nice weekend. Yep. Bye. Oh my God.